Throughout our story of empire, names crop up which are sort of known, but without many people remembering exactly what they're known for. That's not a bad description of Martin Frobisher. He was the man who Queen Elizabeth I really believed could find the fabled Northwest Passage to China. But why was so much energy and money devoted to looking for a way across the top of the world to China and the East Indies? In the mid-1500s, the Portuguese and a few Dutch more or less controlled European trading in the Far East. To get to the Far East by sea, the English either had to go overland to the Gulf of Hormuz and operate ships from there, which was not at all practical, or to sail south, all the way round the Cape of Good Hope, into the Indian Ocean, which is what the Portuguese and the Dutch did. But in the 1550s, that was a long way, and an uncertain journey for the English. By now, everyone, or almost everyone, accepted that the world was a globe, so it had to be possible to get there the other way. It was only a few years earlier that John Cabot, under Henry VII's patronage, had landed in Labrador, convinced he'd bumped into China. Not much later, other voyages had established that the West Indies were not the East Indies, and that America wasn't China, that it was a continent by itself. As early as the start of the 16th century, local people were being brought back from America to England and put on display. Robert Fabian, a former sheriff of London, recorded seeing captured Indians, savages he called them, in King Henry VII's court.
This year also were brought under the king three men taken in the Newfound Island. These were clothed in beast skins and did eat raw flesh and spake such speech that no man could understand them, and in their demeanour were like to brute beasts, whom the king kept a time after. Of the which, upon 2 years after, I saw two, apparelled after the manner of Englishmen, in Westminster Palace, which at that time I could not discern from Englishmen until I was learned what they were.
The significance of these Indians is that many explorers believed they had come from Asia over the top of America, and therefore through some navigable passage. Humphrey Gilbert had searched the classics for reference to an easterly course to Asia, and in a discourse called A Passage by the Northwest to Cathay and the East Indies, he made clear his belief that such a route existed, and that the Indians had travelled it. His purpose, he said, was
to prove by reason a passage to be on the north side of America to go to Cathay and the East India, to prove by circumstance that the Northwest Passage hath been sailed throughout, to prove that these Indians came by the Northwest, which induced a certainty of this passage by experience. What commodities would ensue, this passage being once discovered?
Well, Elizabeth believed him. And who knew what might be colonised along the way? So where does Martin Frobisher fit into all this? He was born in Yorkshire, probably in about 1535. We do know that in 1555 he signed on a ship bound for Guinea. For 10 years or so he sailed as crew to Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean and fancied himself a pirate, as most sailors of his time seemed to. He became part of the Muscovy Company, and it was the Queen's granting of a licence to the Muscovy Company in 1575 that embarked Frobisher on the first of his three voyages. He sailed in June 1576, and on the 11th of July he was off Greenland at its most southern point, Cape Farewell. 9 days later he sighted what was to become Queen Elizabeth's foreland, which is the southeast end of what's now called Frobisher Bay. Here he made his first mistake, but not an unnatural one. There were no charts, of course, and no notion of what this place might be. Frobisher believed that to his left he was looking at America, and to his right, Asia. Christopher Hall, the master of one of Frobisher's ships, the Gabriel, kept a good log. They had charted depths, surveyed shores, taken samples which they thought were gold, and had a run-in with the locals, a particularly nasty incident, just before they left.
The 20th day, I and the captain went to go with 4 men on shore, and there we saw their houses, and the people, espying us, came rowing towards our boat, whereupon we plied towards our ship, and they ashore. They called to us, and we rowed to them. And one of their company came into our boat, and we carried him on board, and gave him a bell and a knife.
So far, so good. Natives friendly, water obtainable. So far.
So the captain and I willed five of our men to set him ashore at a rock, and not among the company which he came from. But our men's willfulness was such that they went to the savages, and so were taken themselves. The next day in the morning we stood in near the shore and shot off a falconet.
That was a small cannon.
And sounded our trumpet, but we could hear nothing of our men. Riding there all night, in the morning the snow lay a foot thick upon our hatches. The next day we went again to the place, but we could learn nothing of our men.
So they abandoned the missing sailors and headed back across the Atlantic. All hope was that Frobisher had brought news of the new route to China, encouraged, as ever, by a disruptive element of greed, since Frobisher had returned with a substance everyone immediately said was gold, even though the London goldsmiths saw the substance for what it was, iron pyrites. However, an Italian alchemist called Agnello claimed that the pyrite was gold ore, and this one judgment was sufficient to encourage investors. So when Frobisher was commissioned for his second voyage, his instructions were to look for gold rather than for the Northwest Passage. On the 27th of May, 1577, Frobisher's fleet sailed from the Thames via the Orkneys to the west of Iceland, and on the 4th of July was off Greenland once more. By the 23rd of September, Frobisher was back in England with about 200 tons of ore. This caused great rejoicing, especially at the court of Queen Elizabeth, who, it is said, ordered quadruple locks for the coffer in which it was placed at the Tower of London. However, there were some who understood that Frobisher had returned with fool's gold. But not all, for hadn't Elizabeth herself blessed his third voyage? It was a bigger fleet than he had ever commanded, some 15 ships. They departed Harwich the 31st of May, 1578. By the 20th of June, Frobisher was off southern Greenland. The search for gold overtook the need for a passage to the Indies. He put ashore and set a marker naming the land West England. The southernmost cliff he called Charing Cross. Travelling in Frobisher's fleet were men who intended to establish the first English colony in this forbidding land. The fleet had included two storeships, but both appeared to have been lost in the treacherous seas and snowstorms. The settlers were persuaded that, for the moment, anyway, they could not stay.
For the bark Dionyse, which was lost, had in her much of their house which was prepared, and should have been builded for them, with many other implements. But before we took shipping, we built a little house in the Countess of Warwick's island, and garnished it with many kinds of trifles, as pins, points, laces, glasses, combs, babes on horseback and on foot, with innumerable other fancies and toys, thereby to allure and entice the people to some familiarity against other years.
The Frobisher voyages may be seen as failures, but they were, as Thomas Ellis, the crewman who wrote that description, noted, markers for the future. The English intended to come back. This was the New World. Frobisher once again brought back more ore. Of course, there was no gold in the rock. A couple of years later, Elizabeth approved a fourth voyage, but Frobisher never went, and instead seems to have taken up the sinecure of Clerk of Her Majesty's Ships. His next excitement was as a vice-admiral in 1585, with Drake's expedition to the West Indies to harass the Spaniards. 3 years later, he was commanding the Triumph, alongside Drake in the Revenge and Hawkins in the Victory, in the defeat of the Spanish Armada. By then, 1588, the search for a northwest passage was more or less abandoned. But there was always hope of colonial gold. That was the reason so much was written to justify exploration, to justify the rights of Christians over those of lesser peoples, even to the extent of taking their lands. For instance, here's Sir George Peckham, writing in 1583.
True report of the late discoveries and possession taken of Newfound Lands. wherein is also briefly set down Her Highness's lawful title thereunto, and the great and manifold commodities that is likely to grow thereby to the whole realm in general, and the adventures in particular.
And that's only part of the title. In the second chapter, Peckham declared that trade was necessary, and so was colonisation, or planting.
It is lawful and necessary to trade and traffic with the savages and to plant in their countries. I say that Christians may lawfully travel into those countries and abide there, for from the first beginning of creation of the world and from the renewing of the same after Noah's flood, since all men have agreed that no violence should be offered to ambassadors and that strangers should not be driven away from the place or country whereunto they do come, we may justly trade and traffic with the savages and lawfully plant and inhabit their countries.
And here's another justification for colonisation. The seed of empire.
It is very evident that the planting there shall in time right amply enlarge Her Majesty's territories and dominions.
Peckham was reflecting the general belief that exploration and the planting of colonies was not simply a wonderful adventure, it was a Christian rite of the English, and everyone would share the profits.
The trade, traffic and planting in those countries is likely to prove very profitable and beneficial generally to the whole realm. The chiefest cause why our English men do not go so far westerly as the especial fishing places do lie, both for plenty and for greatness of fish, is for that there is no succour and known safe harbour in those parts. But if our nations were once planted there, or near thereabouts, whereas they now fish for about 2 months of the year, they might then fish so long as pleased themselves.
And what about the savages?
It is well known that all savages, so soon as they shall begin but a little to taste of civility, will take marvellous delight in any garment, be it never so simple as a shirt, a blue, yellow, red or green cotton cassock, a cap or such like, and will take incredible pains for such a trifle. Now, to the end, it may appear that this voyage is not undertaken altogether for the peculiar commodity of ourselves and our country. It shall fall out in proof that the savages shall hereby have just cause to bless the hour when this enterprise was undertaken.
It doesn't really sound like it, but the motives of this group, and of Peckham in particular, were highly honourable. And although we might be offended by the easy way in which the term savage is used, for most of them it was not a pejorative term, simply a description. These people believed that colonisation was to everyone's advantage. It would grow on them. And that is exactly how the empire was to come about. It simply grew on them. Them being the British.